We Need to Talk is a series of panel discussions that happen in the community. They're moderated by Paul Cure, and each panel has a different topic. And coming up on August 11th at the Dairy Centre, there is We Need to Talk, the topic being truth. And one of the panellists is Dave Krieger, former editorial page editor at the Daily Camera. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Maeve.
Well, I would imagine you're going to speak about truth in media.
Evidently.
That's the plan.
That's what I'm told, yeah.
Well, of course, listeners who have been listening to KGNU or paying attention to any local media remember that you were fired from the Daily Camera, and truth was a big part of that because you had written an op-ed that the Camera wouldn't publish, and it was really shining a light on the truth of what was happening with corporate ownership, particularly the hedge fund owners of that particular newspaper, and what that meant for all of the local newspapers that it was going on. Well, first of all, tell us, what are you up to right now?
Right now I am on summer sabbatical, which is an academic tradition more than a journalistic one, but actually it turns out with the state of journalism these days that I get one of these every 3 or 4 years.
So. Okay. Well, it seems like you're not alone in that. There are many journalists who take enforced sabbaticals. Since what happened to you at the Daily Camera, I know you have been speaking on numerous panel discussions on the state of media, on what's happening, your own personal experience, but also the larger issue. Has your idea of, well, your own personal experience, or has anything changed for you personally as you've been talking and as more and more things have been evolving, or many people would say devolving, as it comes to media in the state?
Yeah, I think locally there have been a number of developments since the effort to make this public. For a long time, this appeared to be an internal issue for institutions like the Denver Post, like the Boulder Daily Camera, like the Longmont Times Call. We were all struggling with the same set of facts. We all had the same owner, the New York City hedge fund. But we perceived this as an internal issue. How are we going to deal with this constant diminution of our resources and of our personnel? Once it became public, which the Denver Post helped to facilitate with its editorial section in April, and which the censorship of my editorial helped to facilitate here, then I think a number of events occurred that made the situation clearer. For example, both the Post and my editorial were advocating that someone local step up and buy the Camera, or in the case of the Post, from this hedge fund and save these institutions before they were diminished to the point that there was nothing left to save. Since then, largely because of good investigative journalism on the part of two people who are not in Colorado, we've learned that that's very unlikely. The profit levels are so great for this hedge fund in destroying these assets that they really have no incentive to sell. And so the emphasis has become, can we create new institutions that will take their place, that will serve the First Amendment functions that are so necessary? And in Denver, frankly, that has a lot more momentum behind it than it does in Boulder. There have been a number of startups in Denver, small online-only community news verticals that have started up, and another one on the way now. And that's not happened in Boulder, not yet.
But those papers being, or online news sources, the Denverite, I know.
The Denverite
has been going
one
for a while. And the Colorado Sun is the newer one. And essentially, I think that's grant-funded largely. I know the Denverite has a different model, but it seems like there's space for lots of different models of how media should be funded.
I think that's right. The Colorado Independent is another Denver-based one that has a lot of very distinguished writers from the old days of the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News, and they are a nonprofit model, and they raise money from foundations and grants in the traditional nonprofit way. Both the Sun and Denverite are essentially supposed to be user-supported models, and the Sun has this cryptocurrency kind of fashionable new twist to it. But nevertheless, when you read into the organization that's backing them, it sounds as if the Sun is going to be responsible for its own long-term revenue model. So these are all sort of small startup concepts that have to find their way and see how much user support they can get and how robust of an operation they can produce as a result. There's another thing called Chalkbeat Colorado, which is education only. And so that raises the question whether some of these verticals will simply be devoted to individual subject matter, and will readers support simply the verticals in which they're interested, education or politics or law or whatever they might be. So there's a lot of ways for it to go, but it's important that we start to figure them out before these general interest newspapers die entirely, because there really shouldn't be a gap where government institutions in particular are not being covered at all.
Well, we'll talk about what that could mean if we have more of our news available online as opposed to the traditional newspaper, where you hopefully would read cover to cover and be exposed to stories that you may not click on if you are just having a certain type of story in your news feed. But just in terms of the funding model, when a lot of this started coming to the public consciousness and there was a search, I suppose, for another owner in Colorado that could take over ownership of the Denver Post. Now, that has largely been put to the side because of the profits that they're actually pulling from the Denver Post. There seemed to be missing a conversation that, well, will we not just end up in the same position if we have another millionaire step in and buy this newspaper? Well, what happens when they want to pull profits from it, or it doesn't become profitable again? I mean, do you think we just need to completely reevaluate how we have media controlled, particularly newspapers? Because I do think that's such an important source of news for so many communities.
Well, the examination is certainly worthwhile. There's no question about that. But at the moment, no one has come up with a model, a digital-only model, that will support the sort of robust news operation that general interest newspapers have supported for a century or more. So the question is that model workable under any set of circumstances? And one interesting laboratory for that question is Minneapolis. Minneapolis-St. Paul each had a major metropolitan newspaper 40 years ago. The Minneapolis Star Tribune and the St. Paul Pioneer Press. And they were very much like the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News here. One was a little bigger, the Minneapolis paper was a little bigger, but they were both robust metropolitan newspapers with hundreds of journalists in the newsroom. Today, the St. Paul Pioneer Press is owned by the same hedge fund that owns the Denver Post and the Boulder Daily Camera, and it has been decimated. There's 40 or 50 people left in their newsroom, similar to the Post. The Minneapolis Star Tribune still has 240 journalists in their newsroom. Same economic conditions, same general revenue issues with advertising. The difference is that the Minneapolis Star Tribune was bought by a billionaire from Mankato, Minnesota, named Glenn Taylor. He also owns the NBA basketball team in that town. And he is simply committed to supporting community journalism. He thinks it's a good thing. And therefore, he does not drag out of it the 20% profit margin that the hedge fund does. He reinvests in the business. They have a whole series of new revenue streams that would not have been possible before the internet in an attempt to build a new business model and support this paper. That's going on in Boston, where John Henry owns the Globe. It's going on in Washington, D.C., where Jeff Bezos, of course, bought the Washington Post and has brought it back to really its glory years in the 60s and 70s under Ben Bradley. So it is possible. It is possible to have a rich benefactor who does the right thing. There's no guarantee of that. You have Sheldon Adelson in Las Vegas, and that's the opposite of that spectrum. But I don't think it's yet possible to say we're going to reject that model entirely, at least until we have an alternative that is as robust as that.
And just in terms of the platforms where people are getting their news from, there are endless surveys of millennials and young folk, or even older people now, who are getting more and more of their news, not just online, but through social media. And of course, I'm sure our listeners are familiar with the dangers of that in terms of you're being presented with a certain set of stories. It's a very different experience from reading a traditional newspaper front to back, letters to the editor, the sports pages, the business pages, stories that you would not traditionally click on or that would not show up in your news feed. I mean, what are your thoughts on the platform? Because the platform, I think, is a hugely important part of this discussion, how news is being presented and how it's being consumed.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, the traditional condemnation lately of the social media platforms is simply that they've been, their algorithms are sort of built in bias toward feeding you more of what you like, feeding you more of what you already think, and that it encourages these ideological echo chambers with which we're so familiar in this country, right and left, a polarization, the extent to which I'm not sure we've seen before in my lifetime. But there is an even more insidious allegation now, and I don't know, not being a code writer, whether these allegations are true or not, but that the algorithms are actually now biased toward stimulating certain reactions in you which are likely to keep you on the platform. And those reactions are anger and alienation and retribution and those sorts of things, all of which are associated with negative emotional states. And so when you start seeing Alex Jones, for example, InfoWars, propounding a series of alleged facts that are simply untrue, that are provably untrue, and you hear the heads of these social media platforms say, you know, that's free speech. That's within the acceptable spectrum as far as we're concerned. You can see how dangerous this could be. I mean, you get very quickly into a sort of a George Orwell world in which fiction is being propounded as fact and supported by the algorithms of these social media platforms.
Now, your background as a journalist is in good old-fashioned print media. And as we have seen play out here, that is an endangered species, it seems. But do you think we can see a resurgence of print media? Now, putting aside the model of ownership and what's happened, say, at the Post, but just in terms of the trends towards less people actually choosing to subscribe to a newspaper and rather choosing to get their news online.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's two different levels in which you have to talk about this. One is national media. And in terms of national media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal are all doing very well. They're doing well with their print editions, but they're doing really well with their digital subscriptions because they have a national audience to appeal to. And so they have a potential customer base of 350 million people. And then you have the local level. And the local level is a completely different animal. First, you have a much smaller potential customer base, obviously. Second, you have a very different dynamic with respect to national advertisers because national advertisers will have a harder time accessing certain small communities. And so I think it's possible to argue, I've heard the argument, that a print product, a physical product, is sort of the epitome of local in the sense that you're holding it in your hands. It's as local as you can get. And it may be harder to find, in smaller communities particularly, a local equivalent online. And that might be why Boulder, for example, which has more startup slash technical slash venture capital expertise than most small cities, and yet has made no progress yet toward an online local news source, it may be why Boulder would be better served by an expansion of the Boulder Weekly or a startup that includes a 2 or 3 times a week print edition. There is something about print and the qualities that you mentioned, which is the free will, the ability to look at an ad or not, to turn the page or not, which the internet doesn't really give you. A lot of the advertising on the internet is very intrusive. It blocks the content that you're looking to see, which does not happen in a print product. So there's a sort of a freedom of choice in a print product that may still, in a new generation, be appealing.
In terms of the impact of the loss of local journalism, there was a study that came out, I believe, in May, and we had one of the researchers on from finance professors, took a look at the impact on local municipalities in terms of the finance. And when there is a loss of journalism, Denver was one of the examples in the aftermath of the closure of the Rocky Mountain News. Bonds, I think the price of bonds went up, or there was some direct correlation between fiscal responsibility at a municipal level and the loss of journalism. The implication being, or the direct correlation being, that when you do not have people watching City Hall, watching what's happening at the county commissioner level, things can happen that people aren't paying attention to.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's the fundamental watchdog function. That is the reason that the press, the free press, is the only private sector industry mentioned in the Bill of Rights because it was considered an essential part of this experiment that our founders were launching in popular government. And if you eliminate that, and that has been eliminated in a lot of small towns around the country now, there is no one sitting through the entire city council meeting who has no special interest. There are civic organizations and so forth with their own agendas, but there is no one sitting through for the specific and sole purpose of reporting to the public what is going on and asking tough questions about things that are going on that don't seem to make a lot of sense to a bright young person who is sitting there with no other axe to grind. It's a key function of the free press, and that is, I think, the fear that a lot of us have, that in this interim, as newspapers are destroyed, actively destroyed by their hedge fund owners, and all of these new experiments are sort of just getting on their feet, and they're all very small, and they don't really know, some of them, exactly what their focus is going to be, that in that interim, a lot of that will fall through the cracks.
And in terms of what people can do, there was a lot of discussion about to subscribe or not subscribe, because even when money is going to the newspaper, it's largely getting siphoned away to the hedge fund owners as opposed to being reinvested in the newsroom. What are your thoughts?
Well, that was a very controversial subject among journalists. And I sat in on a couple of panels in Denver where my suggestion that a threat of a subscription boycott, which is a long-running tactic on the part of newspaper unions back in the day, and I was a union guy in Denver for 30 years when I was at the Rocky Mountain News, when collective bargaining would reach a standstill and the labor had no leverage to make it go, often we would say, as the newspaper guild, the union, if you will not negotiate with us in good faith, we will get your subscribers to sign cards saying they will cancel their subscriptions en masse if we get to that point where we just give up on your willingness to negotiate with us. And my argument was that we should apply that same tactic to this situation and go to the hedge fund and say, if you are unwilling either to invest in this product or to sell it to local owners, then we will amass subscribers and get them to cancel their subscription so that at least we deprive you of the one thing that you care about, which is cash. Now, there are a lot of journalists who take that personally. People who work at the camera, work at the Post say, how could you possibly attack these institutions when they're at this extremely vulnerable state? But I was informed on this subject mainly by a correspondence I had with a prominent Boulder resident, a gentleman who had actually objected to a number of my editorials in the camera, but who wrote to me this last winter and said, I just got a 25% increase in my bill. The paper keeps getting smaller. What are you doing? Don't you think you're putting yourselves out of business? And I had to explain to him, this isn't our decision. This is a hedge fund in New York making these decisions. And I sent him some of the national journalism, some of the coverage of this hedge fund in particular. And he wrote back to me, he's probably 70. He wrote back to me and said, Dear Dave, as the kids say, OMG. He had absolutely no idea that this was going on. And it struck me that many of our subscribers are senior citizens. Many of them are on fixed incomes. And they are contributing an increasing percentage of their very limited cash to these rich dudes in New York who are buying mansions in Palm Beach and in the Hamptons with it. And that's on us. If we are encouraging them as journalists to do that, we have some responsibility for that. So I don't think it's as clear a question as many of the current employees of the Post and Camera think it is, that we have a duty to support these products, even when we know that $1 out of every $5 is going to buy mansions in Palm Beach.
Well, you're going to be speaking on this panel on August 11th, the We Need to Know series on truth. I mean, is there anything else that you think you'll be talking about that we haven't touched on?
Well, I don't know how philosophical we're going to get about this. Truth is a subject within journalism that gets a lot of sort of cynical eye rolling because everybody has their own truth. And as we know in politics, very few of them coincide. But my mother happened to be a philosophy major who studied the subcategory of epistemology, which is in fact the study of knowledge. What is fact and what is opinion? And when you get down into the weeds of that, you're really splitting hairs in a way that makes a number of Western philosophers, if you took philosophy 101, you know, a number of philosophers say there is no such thing as objective truth, that we all have our own prisms and we all see what we see. in journalism, it's a much simpler process because we're not doing the firsthand research. We're talking to the people who are doing the firsthand research. And so in a case like this, where there is no other side to the argument, generally what we're doing is measuring the argument, the two sides. Nobody has denied any of the things that we've said about this hedge fund and what it does and what it's doing to these institutions. They simply say, we have a right to do it. It's a capitalist economy. We get to do this. And so in that respect, I don't think there's really a lot of debate about whether what we've alleged that this hedge fund is doing is true. I think the only question is, what do we do about it?
Well, Dave Krieger, thank you very much.
Thank you.